This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In a new book about Emily Dickinson, Lyndall Gordon writes, Dickinson is now recognized as one of the greatest poets who ever lived, yet her life remains a mystery. Gordon tries to solve some of that mystery in her new book, Lives Like Loaded Guns, in which she speculates that Dickinson had epilepsy. The book is also about Dickinson's brother's long-term adulterous affair, which led to a feud within the family that carried over into a fight over Emily Dickinson's poems and her legacy after her death. We'll hear from Lyndall Gordon later, but first we invited former U.S. Poet Laureate Billy Collins to read some Dickinson poems. He wrote the introduction to the Modern Library collection of her poems. He's a distinguished professor of English at Lehman College of the City University of New York. His latest collection of poems is called Ballistics. Billy Collins, welcome back to Fresh Air. I'm going to ask you to start by reading a favorite Emily Dickinson poem and introduce it to us. Tell us why you love this poem.
Well, the poem, of course, she didn't have titles in her poems. I think she would think titles are immodest, so she just jumps in at the beginning. So the first line is A Narrow Fellow in the Grass. It's basically a poem about a snake and about our kind of fear of snakes. She never uses the word snake or serpent, but she is talking about really literally a snake in the grass, but she wants to avoid all those negative connotations. And I must say, her poems read very well, but there's the one thing you miss when you hear an Emily Dickinson poem on some occasions is the visual shock of seeing some of her words. And I think the very last line of this poem contains one of those unexpected verbal surprises. A narrow fellow in the grass occasionally rides. You may have met him, did you not? His notice sudden is. The grass divides as with a comb, a spotted shaft is seen, and then it closes at your feet and opens further on. He likes a boggy acre, a floor too cool for corn, yet when a child and barefoot, I more than once at morn have passed, I thought, a whiplash unbraiding in the sun, when, stooping to secure it, it wrinkled and was gone. Several of nature's people I know, and they know me. I feel for them a transport of cordiality, but never met this fellow, attended or alone, without a tighter breathing and zero at the bone.
Yeah, you mentioned that last line, zero at the bone.
I just think she's trying to get at the idea of a shiver of fear, a frisson, you know, when you see a snake. But the word zero, actually, it seems to create a shiver in the reader. It's a very unexpected and imaginative way to say that.
Would you read another poem that you think really gets to what makes her distinctive for her period and still important today?
Sure. I think one feature of her poems is a kind of combination of a very cordial, polite tone. These poems are small, they're well-dressed, they're nicely organized, they run according to this lovely meter, but the content is often frightening. And this poem is called I Died for Beauty. I died for beauty, but was scarce adjusted in the tomb, when one who died for truth was lain in an adjoining room. He questioned softly why I failed. For beauty, I replied, and I for truth. The two are one. We brethren are, he said. And so, as kinsmen met a night, we talked between our rooms until the moths had reached our lips and covered up our names.
What does that poem say to you?
Well, she's fascinated with, death is the subject matter of poetry. I tell college students, if they're majoring in English, they're basically majoring in death. that's what you're getting for your tuition. But Emily Dickinson is particularly fascinated with not just death, but the circumstances of death, the funerals and tombstones and graves. And she often kind of domesticates the grave. In one poem, she is kind of preparing the grave for a guest and as if to serve tea. But here, you know, the poem is kind of conventional in the beginning. You know, one person died for beauty and another died for truth. So you have the aesthetic quest for beauty and the kind of philosophical quest for truth. And then they agree as they lie in adjoining rooms under the ground that they're both the same. So there you just have the Keatsian equivalent of, you know, beauty is truth, truth, beauty. But the last four lines are a shocker. I mean, she says she's just the way kinsmen might meet on a night. We talked between the rooms until the moss had reached our lips and covered up our names. So there it ends with the grim realities of suffocation and oblivion when the moss not only shuts them up by reaching their lips, but it even covers up their names on the tombstones and obliterates their earthly renown.
Okay, I want to make a confession here. When I started reading Emily Dickinson, it was at a time when modern poetry, for the most part, was not rhyming, but greeting cards were. And so I kind of made the equation, since modern poetry isn't rhyming and greeting cards are, and Emily Dickinson is rhyming, she's shallow, and it's kind of like a greeting card. How arrogant was that? But putting that aside, I was really kind of put off by the rhymes and everything. So I'm going to ask you to talk about her rhymes and where you think they fit in American poetry.
Well, your reaction is understandable and probably not uncommon. I mean, it was Whitman who was he's the second pillar that holds up 19th century American poetry. And he was really the first poet in English to abandon both end rhyme and regular meter. And for me and you, probably, reading poetry in school, he became more popular because he was more of a radical in terms of form. But Emily Dickinson seems rather tame because she uses this pretty much the same meter every time. It's called common meter. It's a line of four beats that's followed by a line of three beats. So a typical one would be, because I could not stop for death, he kindly stopped for me. And there's actually kind of a pause at the end of the first line, a sort of silent fifth beat. This is the meter of a lot of ballads. It's the meter of Protestant hymns. Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. It's the rhythm of many nursery rhymes. Old King Cole was a merry old soul, and a merry old soul was he. So you have a very conventional cadence in most of these poems. It's widely known that almost every one of her poems can be sung, whether you like it or not, to the tune of A Yellow Rose of Texas.
I'm going to stop you right there. I read that in the introduction to your, that you wrote for the Modern Library edition of Emily Dickinson poems, and that just kind of shattered me.
I know, I'm sorry.
No, I mean, I grew up with that Mitch Miller, that horrible Mitch Miller recording of The Yellow Rose of Texas, and sadly, I'm going to play that now so our listeners will hear. I feel guilty doing this, but I'm going to do it anyway. So here's Mitch Miller leading the sing-along for The Yellow Rose of Texas. Okay, bear with me.
There's a yellow rose in Texas.
Now, that's exactly what you don't want going through your mind when you read an Emily Dickinson poem.
Thanks a lot, Terry.
I can't help myself.
That's really helpful.
And I can't help myself here asking you to now read a poem that shows that meter, but at the same time is so reflective and touching on very extreme issues or states of mind.
I mean, this poem is not quite an extreme state of mind, but it's certainly kind of in terms of conventional religious belief, very radical. And we'll try to get, I'm trying to get Mitch Miller out of my mind.
You see, but, I'm sorry.
thousands of your listeners will be walking around all day with that song in their heads. This is a poem which is quite radical in its abandonment or disdain for conventional religious behavior on Sundays. She says the word surplus, which is here spelled surplice, like a religious garment, not U.S. Some keep the Sabbath going to church. I keep it staying at home with a bobolink for a chorister and an orchard for a dome. Some keep the Sabbath in surplice. I just wear my wings, and instead of tolling the bell for church, our little sexton sings. God preaches, a noted clergyman, and the sermon is never long. So instead of getting to heaven at last, I'm going all along. And the poem ends with an exclamation point, as if she's surprised herself with that ending.
Billy, what does this poem say about Emily Dickinson's sense of spirituality?
Well, it's very radical. I mean, considering that she lived in a small New England mid-19th century town, it's a rejection of traditional religious behavior and substituting that for the natural surroundings of her backyard. The bobolink is a songbird, and so it provides the music. The orchard is her dome, so the trees replace the church. Instead of wearing a surplice or a religious garment, she just wears wings. It's interesting that she just invests herself with wings. And instead of the bell tolling for church, she listens to the bird. And then the declaration at the end is very radical, I think. Instead of getting to heaven at last, I'm going all along.
So what does it say to you that that poem and many of her poems basically have the same meter, that basically she's singing the same song with different lyrics? Each time she
does,
writes.
She sings the same little song over and over again, but we don't want her to change. You know, we want her to keep singing that song. Well, I think it creates a tension in the poem because there's the familiarity of the song, you know, the reliable dependability of this da 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 that just goes on. But then there, within that, there are these counter rhythms that are created by, you know, her obsessive dashes and these sudden jumps of thought.
And talk about those obsessive dashes.
Well, you find these in her letters, too. I think she just liked that form of punctuation. I mean, to me, there are dashes often between a subject and a verb. You know, there are kind of interruptive and strange dashes that don't seem to do anything more than just reveal her love of the dash. But then there are other dashes to me that are indications of a leap of thought, you know, where a comma or a semicolon just doesn't get the sudden transition that as she's moving from one word to another. So a sort of zigzag type of logic. So the tension in her poems is, I think, there's a feeling of reliability about the meter, which is that common meter. There's a kind of polite vocabulary that's going on. And then there's very radical, audacious, and daring content and a completely original use of language. Her metaphors are quite amazing, and they often stop us in our tracks. She did draw on so many areas of things like sailing and geography and chemistry in the Bible to create what I call a kind of, I called in this introduction, a kind of New England surrealism. I mean, just to give you a few examples, in her poems, the sun is all dressed up in a satin vest. Thought wears a hood. The Alps wear bonnets. A book is called a frigate. Angels have hats made out of snow. The bottom of the mind is lined with stones. I mean, these are rather bedazzling, amazing metaphors, but they're all packed into this little song she's singing, as you said, this little song that she's singing all over and over again.
There are many theories about why Emily Dickinson was reclusive, and we're about to hear from the author of a new book about her, who says that she's found evidence that Dickinson may have been epileptic, and that would explain both her reclusiveness and some of the images in her poetry. And since you've studied and taught Emily Dickinson poems, I'm wondering, I know you haven't read this book yet, but I'm wondering what you think about the idea of like a new version of the story of her life coming out, a new way of interpreting what we know of her life. Are you open to that, or do you want to just kind of accept her as you've known her?
Well, I prefer the poems to the life. We have to remember that this kind of biographical curiosity would not exist if it were not for the poems themselves. And I find that the poems are pulling us into themselves and not directing us away into the life of the author. I find the poems are magnets of attraction. So there are many speculations about her, but I think the poems are self-sufficient. And I grew up in an age where of literary criticism, where biographical criticism was frowned upon as a kind of era, something in addition to the poems. I mean, I actually at one point, when there were so many books out about speculating particularly on Emily Dickinson's sexuality, you know, was she lesbian, was she celibate, did she have an affair, I was driven actually by all of that curiosity and speculation to write a poem called Taking Off Emily Dickinson's Clothes, in which I attempted in a kind of playful way to put the matter at rest by having sex with her. This is my approach.
Would you read some of the poem for us? Maybe you can read an excerpt of it.
Okay, well, it starts by, I start undressing her by mentioning the garments that she was wearing when death took her in her carriage. She says in that poem that only gossamer my gown, my tippet only tulle. Taking off Emily Dickinson's clothes. First her tippet, made of tulle, easily lifted off her shoulders and laid on the back of a wooden chair, and her bonnet, the bow undone with a light forward pull. You will want to know she was standing by an open window in an upstairs bedroom, motionless, a little wide-eyed, looking out at the orchard below, the white dress puddled at her feet on the wide board hardwood floor. Later, I wrote in a notebook, it was like riding a swan into the night. But of course, I cannot tell you everything, the way she closed her eyes to the orchard, how her hair tumbled free of its pins, how there were sudden dashes whenever we spoke. What I can tell you is it was terribly quiet in Amherst that Sabbath morning, nothing but a carriage passing the house, a fly buzzing in a window pane. So I could plainly hear her inhale when I undid the very top hook-and-eye fastener of her corset, and I could hear her sigh when finally it was unloosed, the way some readers sigh when they realize that hope has feathers, that reason is a plank, that life is a loaded gun that looks right at you with a yellow eye.
Yeah, and so many lines that you have in there are directly from Emily Dickinson's own poems.
Right. I try to, you know, kind of make up for this, indecent act by ending with a sort of tribute to her, some of her great lines. But this poem was not as, universally popular, as you can imagine. More than one female wrote a poem called Taking Off Billy Collins's Clothes, in which that was described as a disappointing affair.
That's really
even
funny.
Even unpleasant.
Now, Billy, much as I like you, I'm going to disagree with you on one thing. I am actually very interested in hearing more about her life. Maybe it's because I'm an interviewer, and what I do is try to, in speaking biographically to someone, understand what created their sensibility. I'm interested in what created her sensibility to the extent that we're capable of knowing that and understanding that. So I guess I'm interested in what her new biographer has to say, though I really respect your point of view that it's all in the work, that it's the work, it's the poems that we need to know.
Mm-hmm. You don't have to have one or the other position. I've read Richard Sewell's kind of then definitive two-volume biography, and Brenda Wineapple has a wonderful book called White Heat about Dickinson's relationship with Thomas Higginson. And I'm looking forward to reading this Lyndall Gordon book.
Right, right.
But well, I like the little poems. I mean, you know, one of the things I like about poetry is that the poets they're like apparitional figures. Her poems are so short, it's like she appears, then she disappears. And rather than, you know, a 300, 400-page biography, I love the fact of a poet just opening the door, saying something, and then disappearing. Maybe it's the more bite-sized condition of the poems that attracts me.
Well, Billy Collins, it's always great to talk with you. Thank you so much for talking with us about Emily Dickinson and reading some of her poems.
Well, it's all my pleasure, Terry. Thank you.
Billy Collins served two terms as Poet Laureate of the U.S. He wrote the introduction to the modern library edition of Dickinson Poems. His latest collection of poems is called Ballistics. We'll talk with the author of a new book about Dickinson in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The time has come to dispel the myth of Emily Dickinson as a quaint and helpless creature, disappointed in love, who gave up on life. So says my guest, Lyndall Gordon, the author of the new book, Lives Like Loaded Guns, Emily Dickinson and Her Family's Feuds. The title comes from a Dickinson poem with the line, "My life had stood a loaded gun." The book speculates that Dickinson had epilepsy, which might explain her seclusion and some of the images in her poems. The book also documents the family feud over the poet's brother's long-term adulterous affair, which divided the family and, after Emily Dickinson's death, extended into a feud over her legacy and the publication of her poems. Lyndall Gordon is also the author of Vindication, A Life of Mary Wollstonecraft, and Virginia Woolf, A Writer's Life. Lyndall Gordon, welcome to Fresh Air. You introduce a lot of new biographical information, certainly new to me anyways, in your biography of Emily Dickinson. So I'd like to start by asking you to read a poem that has new meaning for you now that you've done all this research.
I'm going to read the poem that begins, "I tie my hat, I crease my shawl," because this is a poem that shows the duality of Emily Dickinson's life. It may not come as a surprise to listeners that she was a domestic woman, but she does in this poem describe an alternative existence written with a capital E. And she doesn't say exactly what that existence is, but there is a certain amount of evidence that she suffered from epilepsy, and it would have made sense then that she led a secluded life. I think that epilepsy is a more sensible reason for seclusion than the usual idea that she suffered from disappointed love. So here is the poem. "I tie my hat, I crease my shawl. Life's little duties do precisely as the very least were infinite to me. I put new blossoms in the glass and throw the old away. I push a petal from my gown that anchored there. I weigh the time 'twill be till 6 o'clock. I have so much to do. And yet existence, some way back, stopped, struck my ticking through." That's not the complete poem, but I wanted to stop there because the last two lines, the couplet, breaks in upon this domestic existence, and I think her punctuation is dramatically important. Every word in that last couplet is pushed apart by dashes as though there's something beyond what she can actually express. And although I don't want to be reductive, I think that her existence is first and foremost, obviously, the life of poetry. It is also the secluded existence, the suffering existence, and in some way an exultant existence, because her handicap, or whatever we want to call it, was connected with her visionary life.
Yes, I think there's been a lot of writing that epilepsy is sometimes accompanied by visions.
That's right. And I myself, you know, don't know the physiology of it, but I think that there is a change in the pathway of the brain. Very little is understood as yet about the brain. I understand from neurologists, scientists, that this is a century in which a lot more about the brain will be known. But to go back to this punctuation, the dashes that struck her contemporaries as ignorant and impossible, and something that editors had to correct, actually gives her writing a kind of spasmodic rhythm. Spasmodic was used in a pejorative sense by her mentor, Thomas Wentworth Higginson. When he first read her poems, he said, they're too spasmodic, they're too jerky. And in some way, we could connect that with epilepsy. But I think that in our post-jazz age, we understand a kind of syncopated rhythm. And also, I think that we're very sympathetic to what can't be said.
So getting back to the poem that you read, when Dickinson writes, existence stopped, struck my ticking through. Do you see that as a reference to a seizure?
All I can say is it could be. I think she's distilling a statement about a woman who has an alternative life, and it is located in the life of mid-19th century women who struggle to do their duty, but are struggling at the same time to control overwhelming emotions because they were supposed to simply behave in a very decorous and controlled way. And one of the subjects Emily Dickinson is writing about again and again is the fear of loss of control. In this very poem that I've been reading, towards the end, she writes, "But since we got a bomb and held it in our bosom, nay, hold it, it is calm." There's that sense that 19th century women may have had, that they were suppressing their energies, their intelligence, their emotions in order to be the model, dutiful, you know, well-presented woman they were supposed to be.
And so the bomb could be like her poetry, her genius, her expression. It might also be epileptic seizures waiting to emerge.
Yes. I think it's ambiguous.
So in the course of your research, you came to believe that Emily Dickinson had epilepsy. What are some of the most compelling medical evidence that you found for that?
Well, there are two forms of evidence, but I do want to precede what I say by an acknowledgement that this is only a guess. It's only a suggestion. I've put the evidence in one chapter out of 18 chapters. It's only an element in a book. And I think that the evidence is quite compelling if we take into account the fact that there is a genetic component to epilepsy. And there were two members of the family in Emily Dickinson's lifetime who suffered from the illness. The other bit of medical evidence has to do with drugstore records, the way she was treated, the medication she took. They're ridiculous, but they're consistent with what people were given in the 19th century, to judge from the medical tome of the doctor who treated Emily Dickinson.
Now, you say during Dickinson's time, it was considered shameful to be a woman and have epilepsy. It was associated with hysteria, masturbation, syphilis, impairment of the intellect, leading to epileptic insanity. Women were expected not to get married if they had epilepsy. There were some states that had laws forbidding women to marry if they had epilepsy. So as part of your theory, you think that if she indeed had epilepsy, that would easily explain her self-seclusion.
Absolutely. I'm not saying she definitely had it. I can't. And because there is so much secrecy surrounding the condition, and I think the secrecy went on as a common well into the 20th century, I think that we have no way of knowing for certain. But if it's true, it would explain everything. If there was this stigma associated with epilepsy, the best solution for her would have been to remain in what she called my father's house. She continued to call her home my father's house well after her father's death. And she was protected by her father and her sister Lavinia. She had a comfortable room. She had the time and space to write poetry. If she had married, she would have been having a baby nearly every year, and she would have had many more domestic duties. I mean, she hated it when she came back from college in 1848, and she had to, it was assumed she would do the same kind of domestic duties. And I think once the nature of her condition was made clear, I would guess after she first consulted a very eminent physician, Dr. Jackson, I think that her father indulged her, rightly so, and allowed her to follow her, what would make her happiest.
Would you read a poem that you now interpret as possibly being a description of her epilepsy?
Yes. Now, I must preface this by saying that she uses I, she uses the confessional first person a lot in her poetry, and I think one's got to be careful that at times, she herself told Mr. Higginson that he mustn't trust her eye, that she was playing dramatic roles at times.
But Higginson was her literary mentor and editor.
That's right. But I do think that there are certain poems, and I'm going to read one, where she is talking in the first person about her own experience. I felt a cleaving in my mind, as if my brain had split. I tried to match it, seam by seam, but could not make them fit. The thought behind I strove to join unto the thought before, but sequence raveled out of sound like balls upon the floor.
That's really terrific, and you don't need to have epilepsy to identify with the feelings as stated there.
Yes, we might well all experience that disconcerting feeling that we are not being as ideally logical as we'd like to be. But I think that epileptics would feel that sense of disorientation after an attack.
A good deal of your book is devoted to the split within Emily Dickinson's family when her brother, her married brother, fell in love with a much younger woman and she became his mistress, and his wife found out about it. His wife had been Emily Dickinson's, or at least one of her most devoted readers.
Yes.
So, you know, the family took sides over whether they sided with the mistress or with the wife. And then when Dickinson died, these two women had a feud over Dickinson's legacy and her poems. These are fascinating stories you tell. So let's start with the story of the mistress, Mabel Todd.
Yes.
Who came to town with her husband, who was coming to Amherst to teach astronomy. So how
That's
did
right.
she, at the age of 27, meet Austin Dickinson, who was in his 50s?
Well, yes, Austin Dickinson and his wife Susan were the social leaders of the town. And Austin Dickinson was called the Squire. He inherited the title from his father. He was a man of grave bearing and great aplomb, and nobody would have suspected, looking at him as he strode, you know, through the town tapping his cane, that he would ever fall into the folly of a passion. But what I would say is that behind every character, Austin Dickinson, behind Mabel Loomis Todd, behind Susan Dickinson, the wife, there's a lot of history behind each character, and it's very hard to convey this quickly. But Austin Dickinson's marriage was not entirely happy. Susan Dickinson was somebody who had suffered a terrible shock at the age of 20, when she was an orphan, and her most beloved sister, the one who'd taken her mother's place, died just after childbirth. Susan didn't want to marry. She was an intelligent woman who tried to find other means of supporting herself so that she didn't have to marry, but she was unable to do so. And Austin was the most eligible bachelor in town. I may say, if you look at his picture, he was incredibly handsome in a Byronic sort of way. Mabel Todd, too, had an abyss behind her in that she married a man who was a secret philanderer. But she hoped her love would purify him. And that was an innocent and rather sweet thought, but it didn't happen. And he tugged her into acceptance. But as the years passed, she did want fidelity. And she says in her journal that when she looked into Austin Dickinson's blue eyes, she saw a man who would be forever faithful. So it may seem strange that he fell into this adultery with Mabel Loomis Todd, but he was by nature, I think, a faithful man, but unhappy, as I said, in a marriage that was probably sexually not compatible.
Emily Dickinson had been very close with Susan, her sister-in-law. And Susan
yes.
was a devoted reader of Emily Dickinson. Emily
yes.
Dickinson shared her poems with very few people.
She sang 276 poems next door to Susan Dickinson. That was more than twice the number she sent to anyone else. And she affirmed in letters that Susan Dickinson was in the know. She said, you know. She gave assent to Susan Dickinson as her preferred reader. And Susan Dickinson was a bookish woman. I think she bought about 2,000 to 3,000 books in her lifetime. She was somebody who read the best, I mean, even better books than Emily Dickinson herself in her youth. She read the real classics like the Brontes and Elizabeth Barrett Browning and George Eliot. And she and Emily Dickinson were reading together. So she's a terribly important person in Emily Dickinson's life. And Emily Dickinson adored her. All we can be sure about is that there was this huge bond between the two women, and that Mabel Loomis Todd didn't have that bond with Emily Dickinson.
Mabel Todd, the mistress, ended up becoming a believer in Emily Dickinson's poetry.
Yes.
How did she find out about the poetry? How did she become
yes.
so
yes.
confident that it was brilliant?
Well, I think that very soon after Mabel Loomis Todd arrived in town in 1881. The Dickinsons called on her, and then she was visiting their house very often. Really, the truth is that Susan Dickinson initially took her up as a reader, an accomplished woman. Susan Dickinson wanted to mix with readers and accomplished people, and Mabel Loomis Todd was accomplished not only as a reader and writer, she published pieces in magazines. She also was a singer. She had trained at the Boston Conservatory of Music. She sang in the church choir. She sang solos. She could paint flowers to professional standard. So Susan was bowled over by this young, accomplished woman who arrived in town and longed to be friends. It was Susan who, I imagine, showed Mabel Todd Emily Dickinson's poems, and I think that Mabel Todd had the intelligence to see at once that these were poems of genius. She would also have been influenced by Susan's view that these were poems of genius.
So we've been talking about how Emily Dickinson's brother had a very long affair with a younger woman, although he remained married to his wife, Susan. And after Emily Dickinson died, Susan, the wife, and Mabel Todd Loomis, the mistress, feuded over the editing and publication of Emily Dickinson's poems and Emily Dickinson's legacy. How old was she when she died?
She was 55. She died early, and it was in May 1886.
So how did Susan and Mabel start feuding about who had the rights to those poems
yes.
and how they should be published?
Well, it would have seemed natural to everyone that Susan, who had been Emily Dickinson's support as a poet and keenest reader, should be the one to edit and publish the poems. And it must be said that Susan tried immediately after Emily Dickinson's death. She sent a poem to the foremost New York editor of the day, Richard Watson Gilder, the editor of Century magazine. But alas, he rejected Emily Dickinson's poem. Now, we don't know what happened to Susan at that moment. There's no evidence. But my guess is that there is Susan, an intelligent, bookish woman in a provincial town who's never had anything to do with the publishing world before. My guess is that Susan was very daunted by this rejection. And she didn't do anything for a while. And 9 months after Emily Dickinson's death, Mabel Loomis Todd, who was, as I said before, a professional, she was used to dealing with magazine editors, tempted Lavinia by acquiring a typewriter and asking Lavinia if she should type up say, three of Emily Dickinson's poems to see what they looked like in print. And of course, Lavinia was absolutely delighted. And it's possible to follow what Mabel did in her voluminous journals and diaries. She kept both. So you can see that, you know, every few days she typed up a few of Emily Dickinson's poems and she would leave it for a while and then she'd type some more. And eventually Lavinia decided that it was Mabel Todd who should edit the poems. And Lavinia began to take over baskets full of Emily Dickinson's manuscripts and dump them in front of the fire in Mabel Todd's home. So in the end, Mabel Todd had a huge cache of poems. And this is where we have to admire Mabel Todd for 2-3 years in the late 1880s. She had the staying power and the conviction of Emily Dickinson's genius to transcribe and in some cases type up on a very primitive typewriter Emily Dickinson's oeuvre. And then later on she co-opted a man of letters. This is the mentor, Thomas Wentworth Higginson, whose name carried prestige. And he became a co-editor with Mabel Todd.
So when Mabel Todd succeeds in getting Emily Dickinson's poems published, yes, how are they edited? Because you complain, yes, that in some volumes her poetry is edited down, some of those dramatic dashes that give, yes, a really interesting rhythm to her work aren't there. So how are those poems, yes, initially edited?
Well, I wouldn't complain of Mabel Loomis Todd because I think, again, we have to see that in its historical context. She edited the poems in the way that was normal in the 1890s. And that time, Emily Dickinson's punctuation and her off-rhymes were seen to be peculiar, a signs of ignorance, of incompetence. I think Mr. Higginson did understand that Emily Dickinson had huge talent, but he thought she didn't know how to set things out. And so we might think in this day and age that the pair tampered with the poems in rectifying some of their rhymes, in putting in commas instead of dashes. But I want to make it clear that Mabel Loomis Todd was very careful by her own lights. She was very careful with proofs. She insisted on 5 sets of proofs because the typesetters were correcting themselves and she didn't want the typesetters to make decisions. She was as careful as she could be in her transcriptions. I think we've got to be very grateful to Mabel Loomis Todd for dredging up this genius at a time when she was unrecognized. And then, of course, after the publication, there was huge public assent.
In the feud over Emily Dickinson's legacy, what did each side of the family want?
Yes. Well, each side wanted not only the papers that had been unpublished. There was still a vast amount of unpublished papers, even though Mabel Todd, in part with Higginson, had brought out 4 volumes in the 1890s. Masses of papers remained. And each side, each camp, wanted not only to own the papers and publish them, they wanted to own Emily Dickinson. Who was going to say who she was and convey her legend to posterity? And each camp had promoted its own image. What's interesting is that both images were excessively pathetic. They played up pathos. So the Dickinson camp, that is in the second generation, carried on by Martha Dickinson, Emily Dickinson's niece, presented a sentimental image of a pathetic Emily Dickinson in a dimity apron who had been in love all her life with one master, one man, and had gone into seclusion because she couldn't have him. And on the Todd side, Mabel Loomis Todd's daughter, Millicent, presented also a pathetic image, but in this case, it was an image that continued Mabel Todd's slander of the ousted wife, Susan. And in this legend, Emily Dickinson retires into seclusion because of an estrangement between her and her, quote, cruel sister-in-law. Therefore, Emily Dickinson, quote, failed to publish.
So in the mistress's version of the Emily Dickinson story, it's Emily Dickinson's sister-in-law, the mistress's rival, who is the bad guy. She's the villain in the story.
Yes, she's the villain.
So where do you see your book fitting into the feud over Emily Dickinson's legacy?
Well, my book is, I think, an attempt not to take sides in the feud, to see how the feud happened, to tell the whole story of the feud, to see the case they were making most eloquently, but actually to see that both camps were promoting legends and that we have to strip those legends away. That's the attempt of the book, to strip the legends away so as to see a more volcanic, less pathetic Emily Dickinson.
Lyndall Gordon, thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Lyndall Gordon is the author of the new book, Lives Like Loaded Guns, Emily Dickinson and Her Family's Feuds. She's a senior research fellow at St. Hilda's College, University of Oxford. You can read an excerpt of her book on our website, freshair.npr.org, where you can also download podcasts of our show. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Joan Tuohy-Westman, Sam Brigger, John Myers, John Sheehan, and Lauren Krenzel. Sue Spolone directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.